Thank you for the kind introduction. I'm grateful to the organizers to ask me to give this Kelvin Sproul Memorial Biodiversity Lecture. Kelvin has a passion for biodiversity collection and utilization. I decided to talk on the sort of similar type of work on rice, with which I was involved for more than 35 years. So what I'm going to talk about is the genetic resources of rice and their use for world food security. I will cover the germplasm collection, conservation, evaluation, utilization, exchange, and the impact of this work. Just to give you an introduction to the rice crop, it's the most important, one of the most important cereals. The three cereals which feed the world are maize, wheat, and rice. Their production is about similar, except maize is little bit more. Rice and wheat are similar. These three cereals provide almost 50% of the calories consumed by the world population. Rice provides 23% of the calories, and wheat 17, maize 9, because quite a bit of wheat and most of maize are used as animal livestock feed, and rice is used exclusively for human diet. In some countries, the importance of rice for providing the calories is overwhelming. As you can see, in some countries like Thailand, Vietnam, Myanmar, Bangladesh, over 50% of the calories which are consumed by the population in these countries come from rice. So germplasm collection of rice started immediately after the establishment of International Rice Research Institute in 1960. So the first mission was to start collecting the germplasm, and this was in 1962. IRI had a collection of about 6,867, and there you can see the germplasm collection has increased rapidly over the years. Some of them was donated by the various organizations, and others were collected by the missions organized by IRI. And also at one time IRI had a rice collector who collected rice germplasm from various countries, and now the collection has reached over 100,000. Also, in addition to the cultivated rice, there is another cultivated species which is primarily grown in Africa, Rhiza glabrima. It has a collection of about 1,657 entries. And then there are 21 wild species of rice, and most of them have been collected. There are many accessions of some of them. So we have IRI has a collection of wild species amounting to more than 4,000. And there are few collections of related genera like Oryza quarkatata, which is now called Potrisia quarkatata, and there are few collections of these related genera. The germplasm conservation of rice is relatively easy as compared to the long-lived tree species or tuber crops. The seeds can be dried to about 6% moisture, and they are stored in the medium-term storage at 2 degrees Celsius, which is this collection is used for meeting the seed requests, and long-term storage at minus 20 degrees Celsius, which can stay up to 50 or 80 years. Then for the working collection for the plant breeding lines, these are stored at a room temperature, air-conditioned room temperature at about 10 to 12 degrees moisture content, and they can stay viable up to 5 or 6 years. genetic evaluation started immediately. These accessions have been evaluated for various agronomic and morphological characteristics, various resistance to diseases and insects, the tolerance to various abiotic stresses, grain quality characteristics. Just to give you an example, these are the various accessions which have been evaluated for insect resistance. These are the major insects which attack the rice crop, like brown plant hopper, green leaf hopper, white back plant hopper, rice leaf folder, yellow stem borer, striped stem borer, diseases like blast, sheath blight, bacterial blight, rice tungro virus. And you can see that the donors for resistance to various diseases and insects have been identified. This just to give you an example of the evaluation. And this evaluation, of course, has been carried out by various scientists, ariary entomologists, plant pathologists, and agronomists. Germplasm utilization, this has been the major program at Erie. Many scientists, my colleagues at Erie, as well as in the national programs, have worked on this and developed the very useful germplasm or varieties. The first emphasis, of course, was to increase the yield potential, and this major breakthrough occurred with the development of these new plant type rices shown on the right hand side. You can see the conventional variety on the left, which is tall and leafy and lodging susceptible. If you put the fertilizer, it will even grow taller and it lodges. And the short statured dwarf rices, which were the result of the of introduction of one major gene, SD1, that has led to the development of this new idiotype, and these new types have double the yield potential. We can normally get up to maximum about 4 tons with the traditional rices. New varieties can go up to 9 tons. So this was a major breakthrough in doubling the yield potential in just one step, which was a very major breakthrough. And this shows the differences between the two types of plants, the tall traditional variety and the improved variety IR8, which was the first variety. This slide shows another difference between the two types. The varieties which are tall, you can see if you add the fertilizer, they will have with the small amount of added fertilizer, there might be small increase, but eventually, if you add more fertilizer, the yield will go down because of the lodging. With the improved rices, you can see if you add the fertilizer, the yield continues to go up. That's a major difference between the two types, and this slide came from Dr. Dedatta, who is in the audience. And this really shows the difference between these two idiotypes. And the reason for this increases in the yield potential is because of this nitrogen responsiveness. If you don't add the nitrogen, then there is minor difference, but it's with the advantages with the nitrogen responsiveness. Rice grain quality is very important because most of the consumers, they have special preferences for the grain quality. Also, when consumer buys the rice, he looks at how the rice looks like. So you can see IR8 with the chalkiness and somewhat bold grains, and then the improved varieties like IR36, IR26, 64 have a better appearance and also higher milling recovery, and IR64 is most palatable. It's the most widely grown variety now because of its high yield potential as well as the high palatability of the grain. The differences in growth duration, this was one of the major factors in increasing the rice productivity. Most of the old varieties were long duration, 150, some were even photoperiod sensitive, which took 180 to 200 days. Rice was planted beginning of the rainy season, harvested in beginning of the rainy season in April, May, harvested in December, January. So that was the sort of the type of rice culture which was before the new varieties came. Now the gross duration of the varieties have been reduced progressively. IR8, 130 to 135 days, also it's photoperiod sensitive, and so are the new improved varieties which can be planted any time of the year. So IR8 was 130 to 135, IR26 was 125 days, IR36 110 days, and there are some lines, some varieties which mature in 100 days. So by reducing the growth duration, it was possible to for the farmers to grow two crops where only one was grown before. This led to the major improvement in the cropping intensity, and of course this also increases in the rice production. The yield potential of these 110 or 120, 130 day varieties is more or less similar. And farmers now mostly plant 110 or 115 day rices. In Vietnam, they grow three crops of rice in 1 year. So you can see why Vietnam is now second largest wheat rice exporting country. So this shows the progressive reduction in the growth duration from 180 to 100 days or even 95 days. And this was one of the major emphasis in the 70s to shorten the growth duration. Then resistance to the diseases and insects was one of the major emphasis, because the tropical climate which is good for growing rice is also good for the multiplication of diseases and insects. This was one insect which came into prominence in the 1970s, the brown plant hopper, and it caused major losses in several countries. It has a growth, has a generation time of about 16 to 18 days, and in three generations, the population just explodes like this, and it kills the rice crop by feeding like this. This is what we call the hopper burn, and this kind of damage was very prevalent in 70s in Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam. And so the approach was to develop the varietal resistance, and for that our entomologists developed the screening techniques where they grew these small seedlings in the seed boxes and infested with the insects multiplied in the insectary. And you can see the susceptible varieties have been killed and the resistant are growing. And these were used as donors for developing the varieties with resistance to this insect. You can see IR20 was the variety which was very widely grown at that time, and IR26 is the first resistant variety. These are grown without any insecticide protection. So these insect resistant varieties were very widely adopted. So these are this resistance is because of the major genes, one gene, and similarly many other resistances are caused by the major genes. So we adopted three different kinds of approaches. The sequential release, where one variety becomes susceptible after growing for several years, and you release a variety with a different gene. So this variety had BPH1, then BPH2, BPH3. That was the sequential release which was practiced. In the other diseases, for example, this is the IR36 in the background and the susceptible variety in front in Vietnam. This is one disease, bacterial leaf blight, which is very serious disease. You can see if this kind of incidence happens, you can lose 50 to 60% of the yield because most of the photosynthetic area has been damaged. And there are differences with very clear-cut differences with the resistance and susceptibility. These are again, these two lines are being grown without any artificial inoculation. This is a natural infection. IR20 was the first resistant variety, and it has one gene called XA4. Now, this XA4 or these other major genes, they stay resistant for about 4, 5, or 6 years, and then resistance breaks down because of the development of new races of this bacterium. So we adopted a strategy of pyramiding the genes rather than the sequential release, pyramiding where you combine 2 or 3 genes together in the same line. So several genes have been identified, XA5, XA13, XA4, XA21. Actually, there are now more than 25 genes which have been identified for resistance to this disease. And to pyramid them, we use the molecular marker aided selection. These genes have been tagged with the molecular markers, and using the molecular marker aided selection, it was possible to combine 2, 3, or even 4 genes in the same line within a matter of 2 years. If you have to do this by conventional methods, it will take many years. And you have to have different races to test the segregating populations to find out which lines have 1, 2, or 3, or 4 genes. So these different genes were put into IR24 background by back crossing. So near isogenic lines were developed. IR24 has no gene. And so these XA4, 5, 3, 13, and 21, these are present in the background of IR24, and by using molecular marker aided selection, it was possible to combine these genes into these combinations, XA4 plus XA5 or XA4 plus XA13, so and so forth, and then the 3 genes together, XA4 plus XA5 plus XA21, and one line had all the 4 genes together. So this was the strategy which was used for developing multiple pyramided resistance for bacterial blight. You can see Karuna variety, which is susceptible. Then that line has XA4 plus XA5, XA5 plus XA21, and that one line has the 3 genes together. And these were distributed to all the collaborating countries, and they have used these pyramided lines in the local breeding programs. Now, blast is a very complex problem because most of the, if you put the major genes, they break down very rapidly within 2-3 years. This is the monogenic type of resistance. You can see the susceptible and the resistant lines, which have just one major gene, 1 or 2 major genes. So we adopted a strategy of horizontal resistance, or so-called quantitative type of resistance, where the resistance is governed by the various QTLs. You can see the line on this side has major gene, and in the middle is IR36, which has the various QTLs, or it's a quantitative resistance. The one on the other side has no resistance at all. So what we were selecting were the ones with IR36 type of resistance, which has a small amount of disease, but not the major resistance. In the selection program, on a scale of 1 to 9, we primarily selected for score of generally about 4 or 5, 3 to 5, and discarded everything with 1 to 2 or 7 to 8, 6 to 8. So what happens is when you have quantitative type of resistance, the disease development is very slow, as you can see with IR36 and other line, IR50, and the other line had first they had major genes, but major genes broke down, and you can see the level of disease. So the moderate type of resistance turned out to be much more durable. Many variety like IL-36 have been grown widely and don't show any much susceptibility to this disease. So this is the value of this is one of the earlier slides showing the parents of IR-8, Peta, Diogen, which have no resistance to viruses and insects, 36 and 42, which have multiple resistance to insects as well as diseases. And this is without any insecticide protection, where you can grow the crop without the use of too much of pesticides, etc. Now, there are several abiotic stresses, like too much water, the submergence, where the during the rainy season there are a lot of water coming into the delta from the mountain sides, and in these big river deltas in Vietnam, Bangladesh, Thailand, India, this crop gets submerged underwater. So this is a very serious problem, and when the rice is underwater for more than 3 to 4 days, the rice crop gets killed like this situation. And there are some varieties which have been identified which can survive underwater for something like 2 weeks. This is a variety which was selected FR13A from the coastal regions of Orissa and Bengal state in India, which was selected after the very severe floods. And this is not very productive variety. It's at poor grains and rather shattering type, but it has this gene for submergence tolerance. It has a gene called SUB1, and it has been transferred into the improved genetic background. You can see the ones which are resistant and the susceptible ones, and this were underwater for more than 10 days. And the ones with the lines or varieties with SUB1 have survived. And now this SUB1 gene has been introduced into several popular varieties which are grown in these flood-prone areas. So those are now widely being multiplied and distributed, which particularly during this year we saw there were a lot of floods in Bihar and those areas, and these varieties with SUB1 gene have survived. I also want to discuss this hybrid breeding, because this has been one of the another approaches for increasing the yield potential of rice. And hybrid breeding started in China first, and then we did a lot of work at Erie. This is one of the earlier hybrids. Hybrids generally have the yield advantage of about 10 to 15%. This is one of there are 4 different trials of the hybrid as compared to the best inbred lines. And you can see that there is a yield advantage of about 10 to 15% in all these 4 different trials. And this is normally the situation in most of the varieties, hybrid varieties. You can get a yield of about 10 to 15%, rarely 20%. So this technology is widely used in China, where about 50% of the area is planted to rice hybrids. And these hybrids have also been developed and tried in many of the tropical countries. You can see the area under hybrids in several countries like Bangladesh, India, Indonesia, Philippines, Vietnam is increasing. And there is a lot of emphasis on developing the hybrids at this time to increase the rice productivity. New plant type is another project which we started in the early 90s to increase the yield potential, because there was a feeling that the yield plateau has reached with the plant type of IR-8. So there were a lot of discussions at Erie between all the scientists, and we conceptualized a plant type little different from the modern high-yielding rices. As you can see, the three different idiotypes, the conventional rice, and in the center are the modern high-yielding rices like IR8 and IR8-like varieties, and then the new plant type, which has a larger number of grains per panicle, somewhat lower tillers, because IR8 type varieties have something like 25, 26 tillers, out of which only 15 or 16 produce the grain, others remain unproductive. And the new plant type varieties, we conceptualize that there should be no unproductive tillers. Of course, then you need thicker stems to support that larger panicles. So we collected a lot of materials to identify the donors for this type of idiotype, and many of the donors came from Indonesia. The variety so-called bulus, these are japonicas which are adapted to the tropical conditions as compared to temperate japonicas which are grown in Japan and China and Korea. These tropical japonicas have very large number of large panicles, large number of grains, and lower tiller. All the tillers are productive. So these were some of the varieties or the collections which were used for developing the new plant type. And so this shows the two types, the new plant type on the left and the IRA type of the rices on the other side. So there's a very clear cut difference. You can see the number of grains is higher, the number of tillers is less, and the stems are thicker. So these type of rices have been released in Indonesia, in Philippines, in China, and have been very widely utilized in the crossing programs in the other countries. And this shows you some of these NPT lines. There was a yield advantage as compared to IR72, which is one of the highest yielding IR8 type rice, and there were some of the lines which yielded more than a ton, or some even 2 tons higher than IR72. This was this had a large impact or influence in developing the super rice breeding program in China. They started a very large nationwide mega project on developing the super rice breeding by utilizing some of the materials developed at Erie as well as their local germplasm. So the Chinese have developed many these new plant type lines, or so-called super breeding lines, as well as super hybrids, which are contributing to the increases in rice production in China to a large extent now. As I mentioned, we have Erie has a large collection of wild species. There are 21 wild species, and their various accessions have been also characterized, and some of them have been identified to be resistant to diseases, insects, as well as to the abiotic stresses. Now, these species are categorized on the basis of their genomes into 4 or 5 groups. There are A genome species, there are about 8 of them. They are easy to cross with the rice. There is a good recombination so that you can transfer genes from these A genome species into cultivated rice without much difficulty. Then there is a second group, the Oryza officinalis complex, which has 8 species. These have the genome CC, BVCC, or CC, and CCDD. These can be crossed with the Oryza stiva cultivated rice with somewhat difficulty. We have to use embryo rescue technique, and the genes can be transferred to limited extent. And several genes have also been transferred from these wire species. The others, Rhiza ridleyi, longistaminata, granulata myriana, they have been crossed, but it has not been possible to transfer any gene. There is no recombination. And there are, of course, two species. We don't know what are their genomes, what are their affinities. So just to give you an idea, there is a disease of rice called grassy stunt. This is the field infected with grassy stunt. It's transmitted by the brown plant hopper, which is a vector, and it's one of the very serious diseases. There were several outbreaks of this disease in 70s and 80s. So this shows the difference. The one plant which is infected, it doesn't produce any grain. So if there is a serious outbreak, there is no production at all. And of course, the healthy plant on the other side. So the large volume of germplasm was screened. Cultivated rice, about 10,000 varieties were screened, and nothing was found to be resistant. Then the wild species were screened, and one of the species, Rhiza nivara, this has AA genome, closely related to cultivated rice, and this was found to be resistant to the grassy stunt. And it has one dominant gene, which was transferred into cultivated rice by back crossing. You can see the two lines, which are agronomically good, and in the center, which is susceptible. So this gene from that Rhiza nivara was transferred into agronomically superior background, and these lines were used in developing the further resistant varieties. So these resistant varieties are now widely grown, and you don't see this virus on the farmer's fields. It's being maintained in the laboratory. Tungro disease is another very serious virus. It has complex two virus particles which are responsible for this disease, and it's transmitted by another insect called green leaf hopper. This is very serious disease in Philippines and Indonesia, particularly. Those are the two hot spots for this disease. And again, the varietal resistance, or the resistance for this disease, was also brought from a wild species called Rhiza rufipogon, which is one of the A genome species. And you can see the lines which are resistant and susceptible, very clear differences. And again, this Rhiza rufipogon was very useful for bringing resistance to this this virus. Also, some of the wild species are useful for increasing the yield potential. There is one accession of Rhiza rufipogon from Malaysia, which has been used to transfer some QTLs to increase the yield potential of rice. Those two QTLs on chromosome 1 and chromosome 2, they were transferred into improved background. And this is the initial test where the segregating populations were tested for the yield potential. You can see Rhiza rufipogon on this side, and then two parents, and then some of the transgressive segregants, which have the higher yield potential than the cultivated parents. And these QTLs have been transferred into a U.S. variety called Jefferson, and you can see the blue lines are the unmilled rice, and green bars are the milled rice. And you can see some of the lines which have come from this by transferring these QTLs into this Jefferson. They have up to 20 to 23% higher yield potential. So that's one of the use of these wild germplasm, not only for disease resistance or insect resistance, but also for increasing the yield potential. Now there is a lot of emphasis on developing the chromosome segmental substitution lines from these wild species. These segments of the various wild species have been transferred into the background of cultivated rices, and these these substitution, segmental substitution lines are very useful because they have the useful traits which can be easily transferred into the cultivated rices rather than going back to the wired germplasm. Just to give you an example, these are some of these substitution lines developed at Erie. IR64, for example, that's the grain weight, which is a big determinant for the increasing the yield potential. IR64 and some of these substitution lines have the higher grain weight. And then the number of grains per panicle, some of these segmental substitution lines have a higher number of grains. And these are very useful for transferring these yield-enhancing characteristics to the cultivated rice. So this is another very good utilization or development of the materials using these wild species. This is the wild species which has a C genome, Rhiza officinalis. And as I mentioned, these C genome species are a little difficult to cross, and to transfer the genes are there is a limited recombination, so transfer of genes is rather limited. So we have to use the embryo rescue technique to develop the hybrids. So there are the kernels of rice and interspecific hybrid on the other side. These are the cultivated rice. At about 10 days after fertilization, the embryo in the interspecific hybrid starts to abort, and you don't get the further development of the embryo. So at this stage, we were able to take that embryo out at 10 or 12 days after fertilization, put them on a culture medium, and incubate it for about in the dark for 5 or 6 days. Starts to germinate, then transfer into the trays, and then finally into a pot. And this plant then can be used for further breeding work. This shows the cultivated rice and the F1 hybrid obtained through embryo rescue in the middle, and that wild species Rhiza officinalis. And Rhiza officinalis is resistant to that serious insect called brown plant hopper. And so after two back crosses, it was possible to select these lines from that distant interspecific hybrid and recover the cultivated type of cultivated plant type, which has all the characteristics of high yield and plant type, and it has in addition resistance to the brown plant hopper, which has come from that wild species. And these were grown very widely in Vietnam. Some of these lines derived from these interspecific crosses because of the brown hopper problem in that country. So the germplasm developed from these various breeding approaches for introducing these various improved characteristics has been widely distributed, freely shared with all the national programs, and more than 600 Erie lines have been released as varieties in the other countries. Of course, many of them were used as parents in their local hybridization programs. So it's estimated now that up to 70 to 80% of the rice varieties grown now has Erie blood in their background, Erie germplasm in the background. And so this has led to major increases in rice production, as many of you know. And shows you the example of one of the impact. The impact is that as the production has increased, the price of rice in the international as well as in the domestic markets has gone down from $300 per ton in 1961 to and $50 per ton during the Green Revolution era. And the rice production has increased from 200 million to 680 million tons. That's more than three times increase. And the as you can see, the impact has been reduction in the prices. Now, this is very important for the poor people who spend 50 to 60% of their income on purchasing the food. And when the prices of rice are low, food grains low, then the poor people are happy, and there is a more political stability and development. That's why this miracle of development which has occurred is because of the availability of the cheap food. You must have heard in 2007-08 the prices of these cereals went up, and rice price jumped up to almost $900 per ton, and there were food riots in 20 different countries. This UNDP study shows that the availability of calories for the general population increased during the Green Revolution, because of the Green Revolution. For example, in Indonesia, in 1965, most of the consumers were getting about 80% of their requirements of calories. In 1990, they were getting 120%. Similarly, China, Philippines, India. So most of the countries, the availability of the calories was much higher than before the Green Revolution. Another major impact has been on the environmental sustainability. As the production of rice has increased, there has been the large areas of the globe have been saved from opening for cultivation. You can see the rice area area planted to rice in 1965 was 125 million hectares. It's now about 150 million hectares. So increase is less than 20% in the area. But if we were growing rice at the yield levels of 1965, we would have that additional area to feed the population of rice consumers at this stage. So that area which has been saved is because of the increases in production on the good cultivated lands, and this has really saved a lot of these areas from opening up for cultivation, like hillsides, the wetlands, and the pastures. So that has resulted in the environmental sustainability. I think I will stop here, and I will be very happy to answer any questions. Thank you. Well, I think the efforts continue, and we have dedicated group of scientists working at ERIE. There is a good international support, and so they are using all the modern techniques of molecular biology, genetic engineering, to develop the varieties for future with higher yield potential, more tolerance to biotic and abiotic stresses, and of course with better grain quality.
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. You did not cover two aspects that I was thinking you would like to bring in. One was the aspect of improved mineral nutrition in the plant, and the other aspect was the nutritional quality of rice.
Yes. Well, because of the limitation of time, I couldn't discuss the grain quality improvement. Grain quality is very important. Some nationalities like soft cooking rice, other like dry cooking rice, and of course the grain appearance is very important. So the grain quality is determined, or palatability is determined by the amylose content. That's the the starch, which are two types of starches, which are rice, amylose and amylopectin, and their ratio determines to large extent the cooking quality. Then, of course, there are palatability factors, which are very important and difficult to measure. So, a lot of emphasis has gone into grain quality improvement from IR 8 to 64. Lot of work has been done. The mineral content, there has been a lot of emphasis on increasing the iron and zinc content. There are two approaches. One is, of course, the conventional approach. Then there is a genetic engineering approach. IRI has a project to increase the iron and zinc content of rice through conventional methods. And the scientists in Japan have introduced the genes for ferritin, which increases the iron content of rice. So that's the that work is going on, and there will be materials available with better mineral composition. I think, yes, SK? Yes, I think I'm glad you raised that question, because there is a lot of emphasis, or there is a big project on C4 rice. The idea is that C3 cereals, wheat and rice, as compared to maize and sorghum, which are C4, the yield potential of maize is about 30 to 40% higher than the C3 cereals because of the better photosynthetic efficiency. So the one of the projects which were actually started in Japan by Dr. Matsuoka, he identified that there are four genes which are responsible for differences in C3 and C4 cereals. These four genes have been identified, and two of them have been actually cloned. They have been isolated, and one have been put into rice, which it expresses through genetic engineering. So it's a project which is supported by Gates Foundation at IRI. IRI is sort of coordinating it now. Several other labs are working to see if these genes can be transferred into rice and combined into same line. And then, of course, there are concerns about the anatomy. There are differences in the anatomy of Siri and C4 cereals. Also, there are rice germplasm is being examined to see if some of those C4 anatomy situation exists in some of the rice lines. One of the wild species has the anatomy which is quite similar to the C4 cereals. So this work is a long-term project, and it's going on, and if it does succeed, it will raise the yield potential of rice maybe up to by 30%. Yes. No, hybrid rice is one technology. I think what happened was that when it was developed, there was a lot of publicity. It can give you 30-40% higher yield. So that raised a lot of hopes of the people. But I think in most of the situations, the yield increase is about 10-15% in most of the situations. If there are sometime very poor checks, you can show 30-40%. But actually, this is a good technology. It is being tried in several countries, but the limitations are that you have not very high level of heterosis as it has been claimed. Vikram.
Could you please repeat the question?
I think this is a problem with all the crops, germplasm, you know, the restrictions on sharing the germplasm. When I worked on rice, I think that was the golden era when everything was freely available. You can get anything you want from your collaborators, and we sent our breeding materials everywhere, whoever wanted. And that was the result. I think the result was that this major increase in rice production and development of these new varieties because of this sharing of the germplasm. Now there are a lot of restrictions. You have to prepare the MTAs, and sometimes some of the germplasm is not available, but IRI has a policy that it will share all the germplasm which is available under MTA. MTA says that the people who receive the germplasm, they will not take any intellectual property on those materials, and the materials can be shared by everybody, not by just one person. So that's the IRI's policy, and my feeling is that most of the centers have the same policy. And but you know, it's there are a lot of restrictions, I should say. That's a very difficult question to answer. I think you are in charge of the wheat germplasm. You should tell us what is the future for that. Or Dr. Qualsett is there. He is authority on this germplasm conservation under in situ conditions. Maybe you would like to comment? No? There is a hand in the back. Yes, a lot of genetically improved rices are available in the laboratory. There are several traits have been introduced. Golden rice is there, which has vitamin A, and then there are rices, the BT rices, which are available, you know, and many other genes have been introduced, but nothing has been released for cultivation. Lot of materials are available in the laboratory. Many laboratories all over the world. Yes, some improvements have been made. There is one line which has been released in India. It's almost 90% similar to basmati in grain quality characteristics. Not 100%, but 90%. And it has 3 to 4 tons, 5 tons yield as compared to 2 tons for basmati. So the yield potential has been improved, quality has been improved, and this is grown in India quite widely. I must say that this work I talked about is work of many, many scientists at IRI as well as in the national program. Some of them are here. SK is here. There was Russ Fried was sitting in the back. So it has been a wonderful experience, very rewarding experience working with many scientists at IRI as well as in the national programs. Thank you.